So once again, good morning. It's certainly good to see all of you here. I'm happy to have the opportunity to be in front of you again. I want to spend a little bit of time today talking about a topic that probably comes up frequently, and the big reveal, of course, isn't going to happen because you've probably already seen what the topic is, so that takes away a little bit of it. But I want to talk a little bit about temptations today. I don't mean those temptations. Talking about the kind of temptations that can get us into trouble. The core verse behind this is going to be Matthew chapter 4, starting in verse 1. Most of you probably already recognize that that is when Jesus was tempted. And one of the important things behind that is because Jesus was tempted just as we are and he did not sin, he can act as an intermediary on our behalf to explain to God that, hey, I know what he went through. I know how hard it was. Yes, we should forgive him. And there's actually quite a bit to it. So let's start just for to begin in Matthew chapter 4. We're going to look at the first 11 verses. It says, "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he then became hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread.' But he answered and said, 'It is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God.' Then the devil took him into the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone.' Jesus said to him, 'On the other hand, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test.' Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory, and he said to him, 'All these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me.' Then Jesus said to him, 'Go, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only.' Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and began to minister to him." So through all of that, I find it interesting that even when Satan tried quoting scripture at Jesus to trip him up, Jesus says, no, no, no. But it also says over here, which of course is another reason why we have to understand everything that the Bible says. Otherwise, you can just see one passage and go completely down the wrong path. So before we get started in this, well, I guess the first thing we ought to do is what we're talking about is temptation is what leads us to sin. So the question becomes, what is sin? Well, most simply put, sin is a violation of God's will. So anytime we do anything that God doesn't want us to do, that is sin. On the other hand, anytime we don't do something God wants us to do, that is sin. So it goes both ways. And as if that's not enough, there's also a passage that tells us that if there's anything that I think is a sin and I do it, then for me it's a sin, even though it may not be a sinful thing. So there's lots of things we have to watch out for. And as we see in Genesis, when Satan approached Eve, we see when he approached Jesus, he's very crafty. You notice that you never read of Satan approaching somebody when they're at their strongest. When somebody is really pumped up with the Spirit and ready to face anything, Satan doesn't attack them at that time. He always comes at us when we're at our weakest, trying to get us to do things that we shouldn't do. And of course, it always makes it sound so good. Oh, nobody will notice. So before we begin, there's three basic Greek words that are tied up in this idea of temptation or testing. And my Greek is not so good, so I'm not going to try to pronounce them. But the first one means to try whether a thing can be done, to attempt or endeavor, to try, make trial of, test, to solicit, to sin, to tempt, to inflict evils upon one in order to prove his character and the steadfastness of his faith. The next one means the trial of man's fidelity, integrity, virtue, constancy, etc., and enticement to sin or temptation. And then the last one means to prove or test thoroughly. So we see there are a couple of words that mean much the same thing. It's trying to get somebody to do something they shouldn't. So the first place to look, as we see here, is what exactly does the Bible have to say about temptation? It actually says quite a bit. The first thing we look at is where does it come from? There's a few passages that we see, and there are a lot of passages that I'm going to go through and kind of just going to read highlights out of them. So to save time, I'm not necessarily going to flip to everything. Otherwise, we might be here until 3 o'clock this afternoon. So starting in John chapter 13 and verse 2, it says, "And during supper, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him." So, of course, there we're told directly who's responsible for getting Judas to betray Jesus. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. "For this reason, when I could endure it no longer, I also sent to find out about your faith, for fear that the tempter might have tempted you, and our labor be in vain." Then, of course, in Matthew 4, 1 that we just read, it talks about how Jesus was led up by the Spirit. And it's always occurred to me that the majority of the world that is not trying to follow God already belongs to Satan. So he doesn't have to expend a whole lot of effort on those people. He kind of already has them. He just has to work hard enough to keep them from believing the truth. So that means he gets to spend the majority of his time working on those of us who are trying as hard as we can to be pleasing to God. And so that may be why it seems like things happen so often. So obviously from all of that, where does temptation come from? It comes from Satan. It's his one big move that he has to try to get us to come over to his side. And with all due respect to Mr. Flip Wilson, the devil did not make me do it. I chose to do it myself. And usually probably tried to find a way to rationalize it in my mind to make it seem that it was okay. So we see that where it comes from, and what we have to also understand is where it does not come from. Temptation does not come from God. James 1:13 says, "Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone." And we'll, of course, get into this idea between tempting and testing, because God will test his people. He just won't entice us to sin. So what sort of things lead to temptation? There's quite a few that actually can lead us into temptation. Covetousness is a big one, and covetous is nothing but a big word that says, I want something. And typically it means, I want something that somebody else has. And I want something bad enough that I just might come up with a way to achieve it that ain't strictly speaking legal or ethical. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 9 and 10. "But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a pang." Now again, we got to be careful. A lot of people go to that verse, but that verse doesn't say that it's not good to have money. All it says is if our desire for money is greater than our desire for God, then we're going to put ourselves in a bad place. And there's nothing wrong with having money so long as it's used in a way that glorifies God. The other big one is lust. Now, it's interesting the words that are translated as lust. Typically, the Greek words that are translated as lust simply mean a very strong desire or yearning. And usually, and it can be a good way or a bad way. And when it's a strong desire in a good way, it's usually translated as zeal or strong desire or something like that. But when it's in a negative context, it's usually translated as lust. James 1, chapter 14, "But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust." And of course, that is exactly what leads to us going to there is, I want something and I'm going to find a way to get it. One of the other things that can lead us into temptation is poverty. We all know that being, you know, being too much in need can cause you to do things that you may not should do just to be able to survive. Proverbs 30, starting in verse 9, we start in verse 7, and this actually shows both sides of the coin. In Proverbs 30, starting in verse 7, it says, "Two things I ask of thee. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, lest I be full and deny thee and say, Who is the Lord? Or lest I be in want and steal and profane the name of my God." So, of course, that covers the next one, which is prosperity. So it's interesting that from this proverb, we're learning that it's really not good to be too far on the poor side of the spectrum, but it's really not too good to be too much on the rich side of the spectrum either. And you see that with people that are, just absolutely unbelievably wealthy. They believe in themselves, and they feel that they are an entity unto themselves, and they don't need anybody else. And of course, if we feel that we're taken care of, how much are we going to be looking to God to take care of us? However, if we feel that we have that need, we're going to be looking to God and putting our trust in Him rather than in ourselves. Also on the idea of prosperity, Matthew chapter 4, verse 8. Again, we read that at the beginning of this lesson. "Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, 'All these things I will give you if you fall down and worship me.'" Now, I've always found that somewhat interesting, that the devil was trying to tempt Jesus with this. Let's see. Who created the universe and everything in it? God did, of course. But we're told by the Apostle John that Jesus was there, and that nothing that has been created was created apart from Him. So doesn't He already own everything? So I don't quite understand what Satan thought he was offering him. Obviously, it didn't work. Another thing that can lead us into temptation is hunger. Fortunately, most of us in this country don't have too big a problem with that, but there are people that really and honestly do not know where the next meal is coming from. And when you get desperate enough, you're pretty much going to do anything that it takes to survive. Matthew 4, verses 2 and 4, "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness and to be tempted by the devil," which we already read. So, of course, what was Satan doing? He's saying, "Well, you know, you're hungry. I get it. Just turn that rock into bread." And Jesus is like, you know, no. Now, I suppose if Satan hadn't been around and Jesus was hungry and said, "Hey, there's a rock, I'm going to turn that into bread so I won't be hungry anymore," not sure there's anything wrong with it. But when Satan was trying to use that as a means to tempt him to do something, basically what he's doing is using his powers for his own glory, which don't see Jesus having ever done that. Any time Jesus used any kind of power, sign, miracle, wonder, it was to bring glory to God and to do something for somebody else and not for himself. Another big one that can lead us into problems is evil associates. Again, we get a good thing from Proverbs 1, verses 10 and 19. It says, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us, let us lie in wait for blood, let us ambush the innocent without cause, let us swallow them alive like Sheol, even whole as those who go down to the pit, we shall find all kinds of precious wealth. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Throw in your lot with us. We shall all have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your feet from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they hasten to shed blood. Indeed, it is useless to spread the net in the eyes of any bird, but they lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who gains by violence. It takes away the life of its possessors." So that evil associates also can be referred to in the New Testament as bad company. Not the band, but the kind that corrupts good morals. Again, in Proverbs 16:29, it says, "A man of violence entices his neighbor and leads him in a way that is not good." And we kind of see that now in today's world. It seems that things are spiraling out of control, and it seems that the evil people wanting to do evil, bad things are having more of an influence on society than the good people that are trying to do good things. One of the other big ones is a lack of a firm foundation. If you notice through the New Testament, the concept of firm foundation comes up quite a few times. Luke 8, verse 13, "And those on the rocky soil are those who, when they hear, receive the word with joy, and these have no firm root. They believe for a while, and in time of temptation fall away." And that can be the same thing. Of course, there's also a corollary to that with the parable of the soils, where the seed is falling on different types of soil. If you don't have that good foundation, it's just not going to build the type of Christian that God is looking for. So, what is the purpose of temptation? There's also the idea of a test of faith. And one of the biggest places, of course, where we read about this is in the book of Job. And take just a moment, if you want to turn to Job chapter 1, we're just going to kind of quickly go through verses 6 through 22. This is the setup where God is arranging for the travails to fall on Job and what happens. So starting in verse 6, it says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil.' Then Satan answered the Lord, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and his house and all he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth thy hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse thee to thy face.' Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him.' So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord." So God had so much confidence in Job that he basically told Satan, "Do your worst. The only thing, you can't kill him." That was the only thing he didn't allow him to do. So starting in verse 13, we see some of the early travails that he had. It says, "Now it happened on the day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, that a messenger came to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'The Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another one also came and said, 'Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you.'" Now, that's a really bad meal that Job had there, when it just seemed that after everything came, something else came that was worse and worse and worse, just piling upon piling. So in verse 20, "Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped and said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.'" Now that kind of sets up the whole rest of the book for what's going to happen. But really look at verse 22. "Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God." Now, of course, that was the one thing that Satan was trying to do, was to get him to renounce God, to curse God. Of course, all his friends kind of started piling on that as well. But through all of it, Job refused to sin. He refused to curse God. I'm not sure that all of us could stand up against that kind of pressure. But it does show that somebody whose mind is on God can withstand the onslaught of the devil. 1 Peter, the first chapter, verses 5 through 7, "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." Now, this is another puzzling story. It's kind of hard to rejoice while you're in the middle of various trials. It's a lot easier once you've gotten through the trials and you've figured out what it's done for you. You can say, okay, I can be happy about that. But it's awful hard to rejoice while it's going on. But Peter tells us that there's a good reason for that. So, what is the benefit for those who overcome? Well, of course, the first two chapters of, or chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation have a lot to say about that. But James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4 also says, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." So again, we're supposed to consider it joy when we go through these trials, not because of the trial itself, but because of what it leads to. Okay, so if we're going to go through that, what helps us overcome some of these temptations? Prayer being a big one. Luke chapter 22, verses 31 and 32. "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and you, when once you have turned again, strengthen your brothers." So even people that we look up to can have these problems, but whenever those problems arise, if we immediately turn to prayer, it helps keep our mind focused on where we should be. Another thing that will help us through this is Christ. Of course, as we read at the beginning, Christ has been through this, and he knows what it feels like, and so he can help us and come to our aid in that time if we will but turn to him. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 18, says, "For he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered. He is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted." So because he knows what it's like, if we will let him and we will ask him, he will come help. Hebrews 4 and verse 15, "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weakness, but one who is tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin." That's something that we should be very glad to have on our side. Another thing that can help us through this, of course, is God, which is where the prayer comes in. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13 is one that people look at often when it comes to the idea of temptation. "No temptation has overtaken you such as is common to man, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it." So if God is going to be able to help us and he's going to provide an out for this, why do I keep sinning? Why doesn't that just go away? Well, it says that he will provide with the temptation, he will provide a way of escape also. Well, he did his part. He provided the way of escape. Is there something that I have to do to help out with that? Well, first, I have to, A, look for that way of escape. If I don't look for it, I'm not going to find it. And once I do find it, I have to actually use it, which means I have to make a choice. I have to make a choice to do what God wants me to do rather than what I want to do. And sometimes that's hard to do as a human. 2 Peter 2 and verse 9 says, "Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment." So God knows how to handle all of this if we will turn to him first. Now what happens as humans, very frequently, instead of turning to God first when something happens, we tend to wait until things get way out of control and then go to God as a last resort. He'll still bail us out and he'll still help us, but we could have saved a lot of that if we had started with him instead of ending with him. So some things that we as Christians can do to help in this. One of the big ones is avoid the way of the wicked, or avoid any form of evil. Again, Proverbs 4:14-15, do not enter the path of the wicked, and do not proceed in the way of evil men. Avoid it, do not pass by it, turn away from it, and pass on. We also want to avoid being a temptation to somebody else. Romans 14:13-14, therefore let us not judge one another anymore, but rather determine this, not to put an obstacle or a stumbling block in a brother's way. Once again, you knew it would come up again. Pray. Prayer helps a lot. Matthew 16, actually we're going to read 26:41. Keep watching and praying that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. The big one, of course, resist in faith. 1 Peter is one that comes up a lot. 1 Peter 5:7-9. Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. But resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. Now, you notice there's a caveat there. Now, there is the comfort of knowing that with help, we are stronger than Satan. And it says, resist Satan and he will flee from you. But what does it say before that? In the middle of that, it says, firm in your faith. It's that faith, which, by the way, is built up by going through the trials, that allows us to resist Satan, to resist again. James 4:7, submit therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So again, that's a two-parter. We first have to submit to God, then Satan will flee from us. So, another big question that comes up, okay, that's great, how do I do that? Well, I can't answer that completely, but the first thing is we need to examine ourselves. I can't really stand up here and talk about specific temptations because the things that tempt me may have no effect on you and vice versa. So we have to take some time to look inside ourselves and say, okay, what is going to be the strongest temptation for me to do something that God has said do not do? And once I know what that is, I need to file that away because then I need to avoid those things. So once we figure out what those are, we need to stay away from those situations. We'll get to that in a second. Another way to do it is make certain decisions ahead of time. If you know something is going to cause a problem, don't wait until the temptation comes to say, should I do that or should I not do that? You make the decision ahead of time. That's kind of a pilot thing. There are certain decisions that we make ahead of time. One of the biggest ones is the idea of an engine failure on takeoff. That's a very stressful time to have things go bad. And if you wait until it happens and you start crunching the numbers and say, what can I do? It's going to take too long to make a decision. So you want to have decisions that are already made. In my case, if I'm at less than about 300 feet, I'm just going to keep going straight and hope for the best. Between about 300 feet and 700 feet, I can turn between 45 and 90 degrees left or right, looking for something better to put it down in that will hopefully hurt less. And above 1,000 feet, I can probably make it back to the airport. So rather than waiting until that happens and then try to figure out what to do, and you often under stress make the wrong decision, you make it ahead of time. There's a big one, flee. Paul has said on at least one instance, flee immorality. One of the best ways to do it is not even worry about it. Don't even be there. Do a classic 180 and get out. I had this kind of happen many, many years ago. I was on a business trip to Memphis, Tennessee. FedEx was our customer at the time, and of course I always had to go back for these program reviews. I always hated it because they never let me talk and they never asked me anything, but they always made me go. And after spending a day in a conference room getting yelled at by FedEx about how we weren't good enough at anything, then we all went out to dinner at night. And, of course, the story they told, we went to this steakhouse in downtown Memphis, which was, like, completely on the other side of town from where the airport and the hotel was. I could never understand why we had to go that far just to have dinner. Well, they said that, you know, Memphis doesn't have many restaurants with a room big enough for this large a group. It's like, okay. So we come back, you know, it's like 10 o'clock, I think the third day we were there, I can't sleep in a hotel, so I'm exhausted. I just want to get back to the hotel, take a shower, maybe crash for a couple hours, and we're going home the next day. So as we're driving back, there's a minivan filled with basically the entire leadership of our division. I mean, my boss is there, all of the, you know, the head finance guy, everybody is there. And as we're driving back, I noticed that they got off the freeway at the wrong exit. The hotel was the next exit, and they got off the exit before. And I'm like, where are we going? They're like, oh, we want to stop by this place on the way home. I'm like, why? Why can't we just go back to the hotel? He's like, you know, it'll be good. So we pull into this driveway, and there's a big neon sign, flashing lights, a place called the Platinum Palace. Many of you can probably intuit from the name what type of establishment this was. And I looked at these guys. Again, you know, these are all the people I work for. These are the people that any chance of advancement that I have in the company, these are the guys that are responsible for it. And I looked at them, I said, I'm not going in there. And they thought about it, and said, oh, come on, it'll be okay. It's just for a few minutes. We're just going to go in for a little while. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not going. Oh, by the way, it's January. So I said, oh, I'll just sit here in the van. You guys go do what you're going to do. And they left me there in the van in January by myself. I thought, wow, okay, I see where I fit in here. After about 5 minutes, they came back out. I think they were feeling guilty. And they said, we'll run you back to the hotel. We want to pick up a few more guys. So I'm like, okay, fine. So I got back to the hotel and got a chance to get to bed finally. They went back, and as far as I know, they spent the entire night there. So that was something that I just wanted to flee. I would have happily walked to the hotel, but that was not a good place to be doing that. Another one is to trust your conscience, but conscience alone is not necessarily a good indicator of what is sinful and what is not. It helps if you have trained yourself in righteousness and you know what God wants, then that conscience is going to be nibbling at you when you're going the wrong way. But for somebody who's new, they may not have that conscience to guide them. But if it's there, certainly use it. And then finally, you can seek the help of fellow Christians. Particularly in a congregation this size, there are people that have been here and have been Christians for many, 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 many years. Most likely, whatever you're going through, somebody here has probably gone through something similar, and they can probably help out with, well, this is what I did, or this is how we can help. It's just a matter of we have to ask for help, whether that help be from God through prayer or from our fellow Christians. So, in conclusion, referring back to James 4:7 that we had just read, submit therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So we do have some strength when it comes to resisting Satan. God has said he will be on our side. We just have to take that. So finally, temptation is of Satan and not from God. God will often test the faith of a Christian, of his people. He's done it Old Testament and New Testament, but will not entice him to sin. If we stand firm in our allegiance to God and put him first in our lives, even Satan will flee from us. So we do have the tools. We just have to recognize what is needed and take advantage of those tools. If there's anyone here today who feels the need to put on Christ in baptism, this would certainly be a good time to do it. Or if there is anyone who is in any kind of need of the prayers for the congregation or has anything you need to make known to the congregation, this would be a good time to make that known as together we stand and sing the song that has been prepared.